Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, May 3rd, Joe and Alan were joined by UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post.
Couple issues here. One is the story that is coming out of Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and the other is the overall issue of body cam footage and when not it can be released, which are really two, I think, interesting issues. Going to Elizabeth City, and I just want to preface this again by saying I have a weird correlation to the case, so I'm recusing myself from most things of it. I'll set it up and talk about it, but not, you know, comment more than that on it. However, I just want to set it up and then let you all go at it on our panel, and then we'll talk about the larger issue of body cams. So night after night, they've been marching, pushing strollers, a grandmother with two hip replacements, preachers, lawyers, lifelong residents, and recent transplants. Some are black, some are white, all protesting the death of Andrew Brown Jr., a black man who was killed in a fusillade of gunfire from sheriff's deputies. This happened on April 21st, which it is the 2nd of May, so that was some time ago in the sense of there is body cam footage, but it has not been released, and we don't know what is on that tape. Because of that, not only the shooting, but of the fact that the tape has not been released, has aggravated racial tensions simmering below the surface in this majority black hamlet in the far northeastern corner of the state. The city's mayor, manager, and police chief are all black. It is a home to a historically black college, and before the Civil War, it was a stop in the Underground Railroad, helping people escape slavery along the river and into a nearby swamp called, appropriately enough, the Dismal Swamp. But Brown's death and the decision not to release the full body cam coverage of the incident has awakened a deep sense of suspicion and mistrust in the community that had thought it might be insulated through a year of reckoning with racial inequality and inequity provoked by the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Many in Elizabeth City said they felt safe from the worst trauma, but not anymore. Daniel Bowser, 44, who is black and grew up in Elizabeth City, so never would I have thought that it would hit here in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Jennifer, let us start with you on this.
Where to begin? On the first point about the body cams and the footage, I think that now that we're in the beginnings of the post Chauvin decision.
Right.
Much of our attention is on video footage for everything that has to do with the police. And I fear that the reliance on that, not just on the body cam videos, but also on witness videos, is a little troublesome, because when it's not there, it becomes almost like the O.J. Simpson trial with the if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. You know,
right,
if there's not right, if there's not footage, well, then it's whatever. We just move on. I think in this case in Elizabeth City, the judge deciding to not release the footage for 30 to 45 days is important. I understand the public wants to see it, but I think it's important for investigative purposes and for audio purposes. Because if you can't see everything that goes on, but you can hear what people are saying or what the officers are saying, that's really vital to how things went down. So for investigative purposes, I understand the withholding, because I do think that that needs to really be paid attention to. When it comes to the systemic violence in policing, this is what we were talking about too after the Chauvin decision, because it's not just the individual bad apples. This gets at the systemic way in which warrants are, you know, officers are issued to go out, or in this case, the sheriff's department, to arrest someone who has warrants, and how neighborhoods around where that incident happens become endangered because of the policies and procedures put in place to do so. Because my other concern with hearing this story is you have 10 sheriffs who go to arrest this one man.
Right.
And then how many shots were fired? Because he was hit with 5. But you have neighbors saying their houses are riddled with bullets.
Correct.
And so this becomes an endangering situation for the entire community. So I think that part needs to be looked at in this video footage as well. How does the one incident unfold because of the ways in which officers are trained to go out and get somebody? Those are the systemic issues right there that need to be looked at and changed as well.
I understand your extremely thoughtful comments about the release of the tape, but does it not seem in other cases where we have seen the release, where internal investigations were also going on, where the tape was released within 24 hours, and that you, even if it's damning as it was in the case not far from where George Floyd was shot, where the officer mistakenly, she said, used her gun instead of a taser, that you know, that did not look good for the police department, but they got it out quick. That it only makes the situation more wrenching, not only for the family but for those who are in town and are now at the center of this storm.
Well, I think this goes to the state level, right? The different states have different policies on who can release tapes and when they can be, or body cam footage and when they can be released. And North Carolina's policy is that it has to go before a judge, whereas right. others don't have that same policy. You know, this is where we get to, we need some federal oversight, but yet states and communities have different needs when it comes to policing and also relationships with their police departments. So it's hard to make a universal, I think, decision on that, because each incident and each state can be different because the state policies around policing and about the video footage. So it makes it a little bit difficult. And I don't know if, you know, when we were watching, for those of us who watched a lot of the Derek Chauvin case, the eyewitness testimony of what they saw was heart-wrenching to hear. And even in that case, when video footage was released, it wasn't all of it all at once. So we get in this area of how does the public who was present witness it, but also then how do people who watch snippets, right? How much of the video will be released, all of it immediately or just parts of it later, how that shapes the mindset and the thinking of the jury pool or of the people there that were victims of it, or say maybe not personally related to the victim, but were living in that community. So there's a lot of questions to delve into now. But I do think some of this has to be at the state level because of the different states' history in policing.
Sienna Freeman Tolbert.
Okay. So I agree with Jennifer. I really think it's important for there to be an investigation sometimes before the video is released. But here's the problem. The problem is that before the video was even released, because they say they're doing investigations, they said 30 to 45 days, they've already put 4 of the officers back to work. That is inconsistent. That is very inconsistent, and that's what makes it seem like a cover-up.
Right.
It's because if you're saying to the public that you want to investigate, then you should keep all the officers on admin leave until the investigation is complete and until you're going to, at the very least, release the video. But the fact that you feel comfortable enough to put 4 of the officers back to work, but you don't feel comfortable enough to release the video is very inconsistent. And I think that's where they muddy their waters. That was the big red flag, is that those 4 officers went back to work,
yeah.
but they didn't want to release the video.
Well,
and in regards, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, that if you say you're going to investigate and that's the idea of doing it, then everything should be on hold, including the officers going back to work, right? Or you can't have it both ways and say we're investigating and then make moves that make it sound like the investigation is already over.
And that's the concern, and that's what it looks like to the public, and that is how you continue to have this distrust with the law enforcement agencies. It's because you have, on one hand, you say, give us time to figure out the facts. We want time to figure out the facts, but before the facts are even disclosed to the public, or, you know, you're holding back the video, and you're putting the police officers who are at the scene of the crime, who may have been a part of it, back to work. And that's concerning. Right. Because then you're saying they're OK. We did a part of the investigation. So maybe you should, you know, let out a part of the video.
Yeah.
I just say consistency is key. And in the second part, Jennifer was talking about regulating how they go out to serve warrants. I think that's a very important piece. I was very, you know, happy to hear that the federal government was getting involved, because right now what we have is consent decrees are coming back. And basically, these are orders, settlement agreements that are made between police departments and the federal government that can be enforced by a judge. And so during the Trump administration, we had zero consent decrees because Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he sent out a memo to Department of Justice saying that you should only use it on limited circumstances. And so we didn't have any consent decrees. But during the Obama administration, we had, I think we had like a handful of them. But one of the most important was Ferguson. Right. And that consent decree with their police department was able to improve their policies and procedures and kind of hold that police department to their feet to the fire, because this is something that's enforceable in court, which prohibits the DOJ from suing them. Right. So a lot of police departments have a lot of incentive to agree to these consent decrees. And so what we see here is that the federal government is going to step in cases such as this and look into the way they serve those warrants. And we're going to see at least one government tool working, because we know there will probably be a consent decree come down after this. The problem is consent decrees are on a case-by-case basis, department-by-department basis, and so you won't see sweeping changes with them. But there is a government tool out there that's working on this issue that Jennifer pointed out so greatly about how you approach a situation.
Alan.
Okay, so the question is, of course, I wonder if anybody knows this. I mean, in the Chauvin case, a teenager standing on the corner took the pictures, right? There was no way to stop that from getting out. Now, is this police surveillance that we're talking about here?
I believe there are five different, there were several officers involved. From my understanding, there are five,
right.
There are
right.
five body cam right. footage reels.
Right. Which is different than somebody on the side taking these pictures, in which case I assume they would have all been out already.
Yeah, there is there was one that went out, but it was from very far away, and it's very difficult to find out what was happening. But yes.
Right, that's correct. So I think that's an important point here. Obviously, there is going to be a reaction on the part of a mayor or a police chief or people to keep as much in-house as they possibly can for as long as they can. And I think that's probably what's behind the reticence to let everybody see what there is, which I think in the end turns out to be a big mistake on their part once they do come out.
Libby Post.
I agree with everything that everyone's been saying about the body cam footage and releasing it and all of that. You know, there's no question about that. My thing is, why do they have to shoot first and ask questions later? I mean, you know, why is it that their first reaction is to pull a gun and to shoot to kill? You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So this guy moved the car. That means five people have to open up and shoot him.
Well,
I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Right, and this is one of those questions where if he's fleeing the scene, is that still worthy of the death penalty?
No, it's not. Look, you know, if it was a white guy, they'd take him to Burger King. I mean, let's be honest here. It all comes down to the color of this person's skin. It all comes down to the color of our skin and how the police treat people of color. And it's this perspective that those lives are expendable. because they have always been expendable. They came here, you know, we brought blacks here as slaves, and they were seen as expendable. All through from that time until now, they're still seen as expendable. We see it over and over and over again, and it's about changing the culture of policing, which I know everybody's talking about, but it's really about changing the our culture, period, not to be colorblind, because that is just an excuse, but to recognize the value in diversity and the value of what everybody brings to the table. And, you know, there are plenty of white people who don't bring anything to the table, yet they keep going. And then we have people of color, black and brown communities, who are kept under the thumb of those white people who bring nothing to the table. It's just an astounding situation, and where guns need to be taken out of the equation. I'm not saying police shouldn't defend themselves if somebody else has a gun and they're shooting, but let them shoot first. I mean, you know, it's like the police are always in this position of shooting first. The cop, thankfully she's been fired, but the cop who yelled taser and then pulled out her gun, I mean, like, give me a break. There's a difference, at least in the weight and feel of those two weapons. Something has to give here, and it's going to have to be white privilege.
If you see the visual of that, and this is not saying anything that happened with Andrew Brown, we don't know the logistics of it, whether, you know, what he was doing, and we know there's just a warrant being served, going after someone else, you know. But if you look at the small visual we have, you know, you have these police officers in the back of a truck with assault rifles, right? And what it looked like to me, honestly, was it reminded me of what I see when my clients talk to me about what's happening in Central America, and you see the cartels walking, like, in the back. It looked, you know, you ever seen a visual of a, you know, developing country when they're in the back of a truck with assault rifles? I mean, what, it looked very aggressive. And if I saw that driving around my neighborhood, I mean, what would you want to do but flee, right? That there's a reason why usually you see SWAT officials in the back of a, like, armored truck, because the visual of someone driving around in the back of a, like, an F-150 looking truck with assault rifles is very, it's very scary.
Well,
I don't know how they thought that was a good idea when serving a warrant. I mean, it just doesn't, that's not the way you approach an, you know, anyone. I just don't understand.
Libby, perhaps you can appreciate this. You know, both Kelly and I obviously are, my wife is a public relations specialist, I'm in the media. So every conversation we have is about, like, PR, right? And we're just like, why would you, just the visual. So this is a tragedy. And it's absolutely a tragedy. But why, first of all, why aren't you telling your police officers and every police department across the country, hey, maybe don't shoot anybody today?
Right.
Just
stop.
Like just maybe. And to Sienna's point about the pickup truck, which is a really scary visual, and can just be taken out of context. Now, if you have backup information, then make that available so people can understand it. But it doesn't look good. And I just from that perspective wonder, like, what these departments are thinking. I understand that is polar opposite of a legal perspective and the investigation, and to Jennifer's very good points a moment ago, but it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
No, and a lot of this comes from the militarization of the police. So the Army has all this stuff that they want to get rid of. Oh, let's give it to the local police department. So now our police departments have body armor and Humvees. I mean, it makes no sense. This is not how you protect the community. This is how you make a community feel like it's under siege.
You know, I think sometimes we get lost in there's a warrant issued for someone. And that right there implies that this person's a criminal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just
guilty right
that.
Away. Yeah.
Right. And that shouldn't be the case. And the other thing that I've found when I was really reading into this and digging into it is that the warrant was issued after, or because it is alleged that Brown sold drugs to an undercover informant. And when I hear undercover informant, I always take alert, because does that mean it was, you know, a cop undercover? Or does that mean that it's, you know, a person in the streets who is giving information to the police? Because we know when informants sometimes give information, they will allege charges or crimes against someone else to save their own butt. And with that in mind, hearing that so far we know no drugs and no weapons were found on the property or in the car of Andrew Brown.
Right.
It makes you look at why you're coming into this place in the back of a pickup truck, like a mob, at 8 o'clock in the morning in this residential neighborhood, the way that they did. And so, again, we're back at the procedures on how you serve a warrant and how many cops should be there and what a bigger threat or what kind of threat you believe this person is based on where you got the evidence or the information to issue the warrant. That is deeply concerning as well.
Jennifer Burns on the Roundtable panel last Monday, May 3rd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review right after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Thursday's Roundtable Panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, and counterterrorism expert and best-selling author, Malcolm Nance.
Let's go to Liz Cheney and talk about this story, which continues to churn and turn. The third most powerful Republican in the House, Liz Cheney, is about to be ousted. She has written an opinion piece in the Washington Post, which I think really lays out her cause quite well. It is basically a plea saying that the GOP is at a turning point and history is watching us this week. She makes the point that in public statements, former President Donald Trump has repeated his claims that the 2020 election was a fraud and was stolen. His message, "I am still the rightful president and President Biden is illegitimate." Trump repeats these words now with full knowledge that exactly this type of language provoked violence on January 6th. And as the Justice Department and multiple federal judges have suggested, there is no good reason to believe that Trump's language can provoke violence again. Trump is seeking to unravel critical elements of our Constitution's structure that make democracy work. Confidence in the result of elections and the rule of law. No other American president has ever done this. The Republican Party, she says, is at a turning point, and Republicans must decide whether we're going to choose truth and fidelity to the Constitution. In the immediate wake of the violence on January 6th, almost all of us knew the gravity and the cause of what had just happened. We had witnessed it firsthand. So there is much more in this, and I'll probably read a couple more sections as we go, because it is a very powerful piece that she has is writing. And she pretty much, Alan, in my reading of it, is, you know, knows that she's going to be thrown out, but just thinks that we have to take a long, hard look at where we're headed.
Well, look, Liz Cheney has not always been the best representative of the American democracy. There, if one reads the New York Times today, you'll see, I think it was Charles Blow, you'll see a large litany of things she did that weren't that attractive. But right now, is she ever on target? And I'll take it, because there is an absolute logic to the fact that we have a despot who's been trying to take over this country and who really is a potential dictator. his friend, like his friend Putin and the people that he admires, Duterte and all the rest of them. We know who this guy is. Donald Trump is a terror. And if he gets back into office, we'll see that. She's on target. She knows exactly what she's talking about. She's exactly right.
Malcolm Nance.
You know, I can't remember how many times we've actually said this on this program, that we are entering yet another dangerous phase in American history.
Yes.
We literally have an entire political party. And let me ask you a question. If you're Republican, call in and explain this to me. How they are.
Email us, don't call. Go ahead.
Or email, okay.
Yeah, email. I don't want to take
how
any calls right now.
Absolutely, flat out are rejecting an American election in which there is no evidence. I come from the intelligence community, completely evidence-based organization, all right? There's no evidence that the election was stolen. It's just made up. And they believe that if one man tells them this, that they must first attempt to overthrow American democracy, and then second, literally rally around the destruction of the two-party system in the United States, and push the big lie, this great lie that if you're a Republican, and I'm looking at you, Elise Stefanik, you have to be a proud pathological liar, that you must actually believe that the party, no matter what it says, no matter what you see with your own eyes, is telling the truth about everything. And I mean, we have people, even Tucker Carlson went full QAnon the other day, saying that he would no longer refer to the Joe Biden administration by that name because he's not president. And you know, hinting that, you know, it belongs to Kamala Harris or it's part of the, you know, grand Jewish conspiracy. The conservatives have gone insane. I can't even believe that I'm saying that. Way back when, about 30 years ago, I used to be a Republican. I was a Colin Powell Republican. They kicked him out of the party. So now they are the QAnon party, the party of mental illness and pathological lying. And it's an absolute disgrace that more people aren't shouting about this rather than observing this conflagration of what used to be the party of Lincoln.
That well said, Malcolm. Vera.
Well, I'm equally disturbed by developments. I think what we're watching is a delegitimizing of democracy as a political system. And what we see is an effort by this sort of new nationalist, right-wing, populist Republican Party to just continuously stir up socioeconomic vision and the cultural form of right-wing populism that pits the working class against international capitalist systems and then uses immigration, identity, race, and religious elements to segregate people in particular groupings. And what is being done is basically suggest to the American public that democracy is not a good system anymore. So this is a very scary development, because Liz Cheney is somebody who actually speaks on behalf of a principled approach to let the Justice Department pursue a criminal investigation into the January 6th attacks. And what the Republican Party that is now emerging, that we see now, is against fact finding. It does not trust the current political structure or even the idea of democracy. So this is a path on which we are that I would suggest is extremely dangerous for the fundamental principles on which this country is based. I'm also quite concerned.
One of the things, Vera, that I don't think, I mean, there's so much to be horrified about here, mm-hmm. that I am concerned that we also listening to Kevin McCarthy is the sexism that is going on here to me is quite rampant. So when the men of both Kevin McCarthy and Stephen Scalise say that Liz Cheney is not being humble enough and that she's like the girlfriend rooting for the wrong team when her quarterback is playing in the big game, how is that not sexist?
Well, of course it's sexist, but the idea among sort of this nationalist right-wing populism is also that you use that kind of language to discipline women. So if they speak outside of what you think women should be authorized to comment on, that's what you go after. You delegitimize women based on their appearance, based on their stepping outside of these boundaries that men attempt to draw around Liz Cheney now. You're being made to feel like you're speaking beyond what your party actually endorses. Therefore, you're an outlier and must be disciplined because what you do is not permissible. And those sexist terms that are being used is simply a messaging system to a lot of women to be careful if they don't want to be broadly shamed and attacked for behavior that is perceived to be or messaged to be inconsistent with this new Republican Party.
Right. And then enter Elise Stefanik.
Yes.
So, Jim Handler.
So, let me use that enter Elise Stefanik. You know, I'm struck, I agree with everything the others have said, but I'm really struck by an irony, which is, you know, Cheney, who comes from a tremendously strong conservative background, you know, true Reagan Republican, is now seen as the moderate. Meanwhile, we have Stefanik, who came in 2014 as a moderate, who's, you know, kind of embraced the modern Republican Party or whatever we want to call the Trump Party, and, you know, is now flying. And it just shows that the people who are consistent and profiles and courage are getting heard, and the people who are willing to say whatever they think the public wants to hear are increasing in their popularity. And it's just a scary time because it's, you know, demagoguery is beating out intelligent argument.
Yeah, and Alan, I guess, you know, there also seems to be, and I mean, you have hinted at this, and I think there seems to be this, I mean, even Liz Cheney talks about that this could be a very big win for the, or a win, I don't know, a big win for the Republicans in the taking over the House next year, but you also have to look at it through the, down the long road.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at here, Joe.
Well, meaning that you can change the, if you change the House, I mean, she's saying that this can have short-term advantage for the Republicans, but long-term you're destroying the party and the country.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate it. There's no question that the Republicans have been eaten from within by a beetle. They're done.
The cicadas, I mean, you know, are coming.
They are. They have been digested, and they've been eaten. They're eating themselves. In the meantime, Joe Biden is doing quite well, over 50%, substantially over 50% in the approval rating, something that Donald Trump never got. You see, because of the gerrymandering and the drawing of districts, that the Republicans indeed may take over the House, but not because they're that popular or because their ideas are that popular, but simply because American politics is filled with chicanery of different kinds, including the way in which we draw our congressional districts. And until that changes, they're going to be a formidable enemy for principles of democracy.
Malcolm?
You know, I don't see how the Republicans think this is going to be a winning formula. But, you know, when you're talking about the fever swamp of the way they believe right now, they believe everything they are doing is a winning formula. They believe that the 2020 election was won. And, you know, so when you consider it from that perspective, which is a little crazy, if I can speak frankly,
Do they really?
I don't know how they think that they're going to engineer a take back. And the only thing that I believe that will really assist them is the very fact that everyone else, the Democratic Party leadership in particular, are not screaming to the high heavens and are just sitting there watching this self-immolation of the Republican Party. But the problem is their flames are going to destroy American democracy. And so I'm quite surprised the counter messaging against this is not being pushed. And this is where Democrats make mistakes. Okay. What they always do is say, we're going to let our good work speak for us. And that's awesome. Excuse me. It's awesome. It's very Christ-like. And granted, Jesus Christ won in the long term, but, you know, on Golgotha, it didn't work out too well for him. So, you know, we are not made of the same ilk, you know. So we have to actually go forward and push not just the agenda that's working right now. Things are going great for the Biden administration, but we have to actually start calling out the other party as broken. We have to start calling the other party as being dangerous to America. We have to stoke our own followers to believe that the 2022 election could literally destroy everything that we have. If they take back the Senate or they take back the House, it's all done. Once again, both. We go right back to 2016, and they're set up to put some crazy, whether it's Elise Stefanik or whether it's, you know, Donald Trump again, back on the ballot for the presidency in 2024. The messaging has got to be better than we inoculated all these people.
Let's go to letters. We begin with Russ, who says the Republican Party is closing ranks around nativism and cultural grievance. Their attempt to co-opt the populist mantle has been hopelessly preempted by Biden's working class-oriented policy initiatives. The Republican caucus is too divided on economic issues to do much more than support the Trump tax cuts, his only legislative accomplishment, though he did not personally have a hand in the shaping of that legislation. As a result, the majority of independent voters are unlikely to see the Republican Party as friendly to their pocketbooks. Then we go to John. The Republican Party, henceforth to be called the GQP, is not just nationalist, but white nationalist, Christianist extremist. I dislike using the term populist because what we keep calling populist is very demagoguery. We need to start calling it that, demagoguery. We need to start calling these GOP politicians demagogues. We need to start calling things what they are. That from John.
Here.
We go to PJ, who says, please stop using the word conservative to define Trumpists and the loony right, as no conservative supports Trump or QAnon. The brilliant Edmund Burke would never support Trump.
No conservative? I'll bet you're wrong.
That's an interesting point. Let's see. We go to Tom. Colin Powell was the one that perpetuated the real big lie. Iraq had mass weapons of mass destructions. I'm not sure one would be proud of that fact. There is a world where Joe Biden won the election and there was election fraud. Anyone who wants a free democratic society would welcome examining issues with the U.S. elections. There were many Democrats who objected to Trump winning in 2016, and they were not banished from the party. Elise Stefanik has never stated the election was stolen. She clearly laid out the issues in specific states that should be looked at.
Elise Stefanik voted to not certify the election on January 6th, which meant she supported the insurrection to overthrow the government of the United States and the seditionists and the sedition that's still being occurred. That's occurring right now. That's the only way we can justify what she did, unless she comes right out and pulls a full Lynn Cheney and starts saying, I believe Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States. She can't get off the hook. All of the election fraud that was committed in this election, maybe what? What did they say? 10, 15 cases were perpetrated by Republicans. Three in Pennsylvania alone, where they had double voted for dead people, all Republicans. This is the cleanest election we've ever had. But we cannot allow the lie to stand, and we can't allow people to come and say, well, both sides have done it. Look, you can object to an election like we did in 2016. There were irregularities. People were working with foreign governments. But we never said that Donald Trump didn't get elected president. He got more votes. He got more electoral college votes. But for them to come up and say, this government's illegitimate, it didn't happen, we should overthrow the government, which they continue to support, well, that's a completely different story.
And then less of a rant, I would say, you know, just look what's going on. I mean, look at Arizona and their insane attempt to re-examine, he says politely, the vote. I mean, they're doing things like they're looking for bamboo because they think maybe China dumped votes in. They're looking now, they're threatening to start going and asking voters in person who they voted for, so they can check, which, by the way, is federally illegal and you know, just insane. And, you know, Stefanik has not in any way rejected or criticized those who are doing the, you know, calling things out. So, you know, when he says they were the, you know, she's calling out these legitimate challenges. No, these challenges have all been examined. They've all been looked at. The data is there. The data is public. You can look at it yourself.
Jim Hendler on the roundtable panel on Thursday, May 6th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Producer Sarah LaDuc. On Friday, May 7th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by former EPA Regional Administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Vicitti, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
We have the new jobless numbers that were expected to be, I guess, the initial expectation was for them to be robust, was the word they just used, on a marketplace. But the U.S. added 266,000 jobs in April, which is actually a dramatic slowdown. The reported numbers were far below what economists had expected in the sharp drop from March and that month's rapid hiring pace. So, make sense of it, please, Dr. Herr.
Sure. So the U.S. economy added 266,000 jobs in April, and forecasters were expecting close to a million. So that's far below expectations, and also about a third of the number of jobs that the economy added in March. So the unemployment rate is pretty much held constant at 6.1%. So yes, it was below expectations. It was a slowdown. But it's still only 1 month worth of data. You know, when an economy is around a turning point, when it's coming out of a recession or going into a recession, usually there's some sharp jumps in the monthly data. So I don't think economists are going to make too much of a big deal about this just because it's only 1 month and it comes on the heels of February and March, which were two very strong months. So it's very likely that as warm weather starts to increase, as the pace of vaccination starts to increase, that we'll start to see job numbers creep back up. So it's important to remember that, you know, employment is still down 10% since the start of the pandemic, which means about half of the jobs that we lost during the pandemic have been recovered. So there's still a pretty deep hole, and the economy's got a long way to climb out of it. The other thing that I kind of want to address, and I'm starting to see a lot of kind of anecdotal reports of this pop up, is that, you know, the reason the economy is not adding jobs is because there's a labor shortage.
Right.
Firms just can't find enough
right.
qualified workers. And I kind of want to throw some cold water on that because, you know, to economists, if there is a true shortage of goods or a true shortage of workers, you would expect to see competition bid up wages. And wage growth is very contained. So
let me just interrupt you.
I want to spend some time kind of.
I just want to interrupt you for 1 second because I very much want to talk about this. And I just want to set this up a little tiny bit because you talk about the anecdotal nature of it. But it's impossible to go to just about anywhere and not see a help wanted sign in the window. And what is really interesting, again, anecdotal, but what's really interesting is there are stores and places that have closed down and businesses that are not able to open because they have nowhere to work. And places that are trying to reopen, like certain museums and certain facilities that have not been open in a long time, are trying to reopen, but they can't find anybody to work. So and that is true, and that is really difficult for these places because it is extremely difficult. I was talking to a major business in our region a few days ago, and they said, you know, we had a job fair. We normally get 2,000 applications. We got 17. Well, goodness gracious, what do you do? So with that in mind, Aaron, tell us what's going on. I'm glad you're going to throw cold water on it, but it seems like it's something to be concerned about.
And Joe and Aaron, if I could just add one thing to that, and that is anecdotally, again, Joe, everywhere you go, they're saying it's the unemployment insurance that's doing it. People
right.
want it.
The $300 is keep you. That, you make more the, money the, staying home than you do going to work.
Right. Throw cold water on that one, too, if you
yes.
will.
Hey, I got a bucket of cold water. I just wanted following Joe and Alan. You know, I you have to reflect on just how many industries are still shut down. I mean, you think of, you know, this time, you know, 2 years ago, we'd be at the movie theater, you know,
right.
you know, going to the next Marvel movie. So, you know, these employees that have been laid off and, you know, have been struggling for the last year, it's not as if you can just ring a bell and all of a sudden they're going to be returning. I mean, I don't know that these numbers account for it, but in closing, I do believe you need a little Barry White background soundtrack while you're doing your thing, Brother Aaron.
Now, Judith, do you want to add on to the question to Aaron before we finally hand it over to him with very little time?
No,
before the...
I just okay. want to hear Aaron speak.
Aaron, you
give
have the
man the microphone.
Aaron, you have the floor for the next 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to say that I prefer Al Green to Barry White. That said, so this is a serious issue, like Joe pointed out. I'm not trying to make light of it. Particularly small businesses
right.
Are having a very difficult time finding workers to open. Job openings have gone up 34% over the past couple months. But applications for jobs have gone down by 13%. So businesses want to hire. There are positions that are, you know, that firms are trying to fill, but there's not workers for it. So I think there's two forces at play. The first one is that firms are unwilling to pay a wage that would attract a worker. They're unwilling to provide a benefit package that would make that job worthwhile for a potential employee. And the second issue is that, you know, the past year has really upended a lot of things. And one of those is employee motivation and personal choices. So there are a lot of non-government subsidy related reasons. And I think the biggest one is health concerns that for a lot of people, going back to a, you know, a $12 an hour job is just not worth it when the risk of getting infected is still very real. A lot of these jobs have in-person requirements, and a lot of employees just might not feel comfortable going back to positions like that. A lot of employees are caring for children who are learning from home. A lot of people are caring for elderly relatives. And, you know, if a job doesn't provide paid medical and family leave, taking care of family members becomes very, very difficult. So I think those are two very big concerns. In addition to that, there is the very real phenomenon that for some workers, they're receiving more from unemployment benefits than they would if they were working. So I did the math on this, and I will spare everybody the formulas and assumptions, but for workers who are earning less than $12.50 an hour, unemployment insurance with the $300 weekly subsidy pays more than they could get by working at a job full time. So the workers who are earning more by being unemployed than they would be working are the lowest of the low paid workers. So again, that's a sign that businesses aren't paying wages that are high enough to compensate employees for the increased risk of infection, for the increased inconvenience of having a job, but also having to take care of a kid or an elderly relative. So it's a weird situation, and the easiest way to resolve it is for businesses to raise wages. But that's very difficult for small businesses who tend to operate on much thinner profit margins. So bigger employers like Amazon and Walmart and Target can absorb, you know, somewhat larger wage increases. But, the local, mom and pop shop in Cambridge or on Broadway in Saratoga can't just, raise wages from $12.50 an hour to, $25 an hour without experiencing a huge hit to their profits. So, I think workers are making very important decisions that, their health and the health of their family is more important than taking low-wage jobs. And hopefully over the long term, this will allow workers to find a better fit with jobs. But until then, until employers raise wages and until the public health threat disappears, I still think we're going to be seeing reports of labor shortages.
Miraculously, I think you answered all 17 questions we threw at you. So I thank you very much for that. Judith, anything you would like to add to the... and then we'll go to David. Where, David, do you want to go first? I called on Judith.
We're going to let Judith go. Yeah, she has a longer Judith. Title than I do.
Thank you, David. All you have is two initials.
I think the pandemic really put the spotlight on economic inequality in this country, and it continues to play out. I mean, people with Zoomable jobs who were able to work from home, figure out childcare, did a lot better than people who were on the front lines economically. And if you had to go to the supermarket or the nursing home or wherever you were working, you couldn't really do Zoom school at home with your kid. And I think these economic fissures are just getting, more and more intense. And I'm a little worried about some of the comments, not on this show per se, about, people get paid a whole lot more staying home and not working because of those high unemployment benefits. It's actually not that much money, and good luck living on that income. So I think lots and lots of work to do. And I was, really focused on Aaron's point about, maybe you could pay more for a minimum wage job when you're expected to be directly dealing with the public all day long. And yeah, I think the beginning of the pandemic, we just saw all these horrible scenes at convenience stores where the poor minimum wage clerk had to fight with the person for not wearing the mask. I mean, these people are not paid enough for what they're asked to do.
David Soares.
No, I echo a lot of what Judith said. I get very angry and resentful when I hear the cynics talk about how, you know, all of a sudden we've developed this culture of people that have always worked hard, but now that they're getting this little drop in the bucket of relief, all of a sudden they're abandoning their work ethic. I despise that commentary. But I also, you know, the story about the unemployment and the figures that we always discuss, they barely tell the real stories about what's happened to our country and what's happened to our people. You know, we've lost so many loved ones. Our workers have lost, you know, loved ones. You know, children have been displaced from school. So between losing people, between having the course of your life and your routines and institutions that workers have always relied upon, all of those things shutting down and failing, of course it's going to contribute to the economy that we have. And I think it's going to take time to rebound. But, you know, just think for a moment where we would be if, when all of this was happening, we actually had an administration that was taking into consideration all the issues that the Biden administration are currently dealing with, acknowledging the fact that we do have to provide for child care and all of these other, you know, issues and considerations in order to bring this economy back. They're right. As we're sitting here discussing this, the policies that they've developed are right, because the only way that we get back to a strong economy, it's through our people.
So let's go to some letters here. We have many, and I want to some have direct questions for Aaron, so I'll get to those as well. Scott says, almost every employer I know is hiring. The government needs to stop subsidizing unemployment with additional funds. The majority of Americans are willing to accept 75% of a wage to sit and do nothing. Cut the additional unemployment pay and people will get to work. These are some of the comments that we were anticipating. Jerome.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, that's right. You nailed that one, Judith. Good for you. Jerome says, all these employers that complain you can't find an employee because they get paid more on unemployment than they do working, perhaps should rethink how much they pay their employees. Unemployment insurance pays what could come out to about $15 an hour for a 40-hour week, just saying. You know, I've been, again, this is anecdotal, but I have looking at businesses in our region, especially in the tourist corridors of Saratoga and of Glens Falls and Lake George. And I mean, there's places that are saying, OK, if you can't get to work, we will pick you up on a bus, bring you to work, bring you back, give you food. Here's your wage. And, you know, places are trying to do their best to get people, and we'll see what impact that has, especially as summer gears up and by some accounts things should be much more open up than they are now. Bill says, or have been in the past few months, Bill says, I wonder how much the huge increase in the price of building materials and the shortage of building materials are factored into the jobs report. Construction will probably lag for as long as shortages endure. Yes, try buying lumber. Aaron?
Yeah, construction was one of the sectors in the job report that did not perform well. And, you know, so there was like no net change in construction this month. And, you know, the rising cost of raw materials of lumber, which is independent of unemployment insurance or anything, is just going to depress activity. So, yeah, there's a lot of factors at play here, including, you know, lumber and raw material prices.
Aaron Bassetti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, May 7th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.